All right, so it is now 2:02, so I think we'll get started. First thing I'm going to do is to mute you all, and we'll keep it muted during the presentation so we don't have a lot of ambient noise. And then after the presentations, we'll open it up for questions.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
Okay, so hi everybody. Hi UUCEF investors. I'm Tim Brennan. I'm the UUA's Treasurer and Chief Financial Officer. And I'm joined by Kathleen Gaffney, who is the Chair of our Investment Committee, and Kathy Mulvey, who is the Chair of the Socially Responsible Investment Committee. So what we will be doing today is first going over a performance review of the portfolio. Second, we'll be talking about the investment committee meeting and decisions and actions that the committee made, as well as the socially responsible investment committee. And then we'll open it up for all of your questions and answers. So with that, it's going to help you to follow the call if you look at the slide presentation, and that is available on our website. So that's uucef.org. And if you go to that page and you look over in the right column, you will see something that says View August Investor Call Materials. And if you click on that, you'll get a PDF of the presentation. I think both Kathleen and Kathy will be referring to that slide deck. So with that, let me turn it over to Kathleen Gaffney for a review of the performance of the fund.
Great. Thanks, Tim, and thank you so much for highlighting the materials. It will make it a lot easier to follow along. And I am going to start on page 3 to discuss the performance. We have our gross returns here versus our peer universe. And just to remind you all that our peer universe is other endowments in the size of the range of 50 to 250 million. Those are our peers, and I'm happy to report that recent numbers, as well as our long-term numbers, all are in a very positive ranking versus our peers. If we look at the most recent performance that we have for the second quarter of 2018, the UUCEF returned 1.1% with a ranking of 32, so 32nd percentile, above median. And for the one-year number, the trailing one-year number, which happens to be our fiscal year, the UUCEF returned 9.9% with a ranking of in the fifth percentile. I think what's important about noting the rankings here, as well as where we are performing relative to our allocation and policy index, we're outperforming. And what that is a reflection of is the return of active management in driving overall returns. There's been, as I have mentioned on this call before, a tremendous focus on market returns and efficiencies, and the way we work with our consultant, NEPC, is to balance efficiency of delivering market returns and market exposure with an ESG lens, so to deliver in terms of strong performance, which requires an active monitoring of the managers that we select. And so I think this is a worth noting that over this time frame, this has clearly been a benefit. And if you look at the longer-term numbers, the 10-year that you see at the far right-hand side, you'll notice that the UUCEF has returned 6.6% with a 36th percentile ranking, again, above median of our peers. And over that time frame, the 6.6 outperforms the policy and allocation index. So our managers, with their specific objectives, whether it is to simply beat the benchmark and by investing in lower cost efficient strategies, or whether they can deliver additional alpha, and that has worked well for us. On slide 4, you can see in a bit more detail on an annual basis over the last 10 years what the annual returns reflect. And I would, again, highlight that what you're seeing is strong performance. You'll note 2017, the fund was up 18.5%, fifth percentile. And as you go move towards the right, you will see that those longer-term numbers in years 2009, for example, 2010, 2012, which were 2011 and 2012, not easy years. In 2009, you had to be in the right market. Our rankings clearly demonstrate the importance of selecting your managers well.
I can't wait until 2008 drops off.
Exactly. So it's a strategy that's clearly working for the committee. And on the next 3 slides, you have the details of who those managers are and how they've contributed to the overall return. I'm going to just highlight a few and focus primarily on the one-year numbers because it's long enough but also recent enough to demonstrate the benefits of active management. 1 year, as I mentioned earlier, on the 1 year basis, which is, again, fiscal year, 9.8%. And as you move down into the domestic equity composite, so this is all of our equity managers, Rumline, Sands, Wellington, SMID, small cap, small mid-cap investments, and Kennedy Capital. What you see is we've been able to achieve 21.2 versus the Russell 3000 at 16.4. And I think what also is interesting, and I believe I pointed this out on the last call as well, but that first manager, Rumline, is an index manager. However, they work with a screen, an ESG screen, that the staff works with Sustainalytics to adhere to the UUA principles. And so this is an index-style strategy, and yet because of the ESG lens, it's very interesting to see that the returns have been 14.6 versus 9.5 over the trailing 12 months. Our growth manager, Sands, who can be a more volatile manager but has demonstrated a strong track record over the long term. Growth has been an area in the equity markets that has done exceptionally well, and we realized a one-year return of 28.5 versus 22.8. Wellington also performed well, and Kennedy is a recent addition to the stable of domestic equity managers. The International Equity Group had lower returns than the U.S. market, not a surprise there, but you'll note that 6.6 versus the International Equity Composite, the MSCI ACWI as it's known, was 5.9. And MFS International, I think, stands out as being a primary driver of those returns. That's the performance for the equity component of the fund. On the fixed income side, you'll note, I hope, that we also have a blend of active managers as well as more traditional index-like managers. And on a one-year basis, while fixed income, we've seen a backup in rates as the short end moves up. The fixed income component delivered a small negative, 0.1% versus the broad market, which was down 0.8%, reflecting rising interest rates. However, we've got a number of managers who have flexibility and the ability to invest away from the U.S., and that has helped us outperform. The Loomis multi-sector strategy returned a positive 1.1 versus a negative 1% for the U.S. Gov credit, again through additional flexibility. And Franklin Templeton, which has expertise on the global side, delivered a 1% return versus negative 0.4. So this is a good example of a sector of the market where it's important to have exposure, but as rates start to rise, the mix of our fixed income managers is allowing us to not be so sensitive to the gradual march higher in interest rates. Now, at the bottom of slide 6, you will see we have a category of opportunistic investments. The policy target, the third column over, is a target of 20%, and we're currently underweight at 13.7%. Most of the exposure right now is with one manager, GMO, that has been a topic of discussion with the committee for much of this year, and we've focused with our consultant, NEPC. You'll notice this is one of the highlights that I'm going to talk about, is what is the purpose of our opportunistic investments. We've moved away from a strategic allocation to hedge funds. We like the idea of opportunistic investments as allowing us to potentially add more return that may not be correlated to the broad market, but this is one of the reasons why we had a discussion on opportunistic investments. On slide 7, you will notice that we have a small allocation to private markets. Policy target is 5%. We're currently just under 3%. This is an area of the market where many investors are focused right now as valuations on the public side seem stretched. And I think it's important for all of you to know that we are looking at these opportunities on a regular basis, but being extremely disciplined at what fits for the UUCF in terms of our mandate and objectives. And also are really trying to focus more on private investments that have an impact orientation. excuse me. This is a segment of the portfolio that should have, again, a low correlation to the broad market, but should be a source of longer-term return. And it's an area that the committee, the joint committee, I think, It's a great turn with the our ability to work jointly with the SRIC, particularly because we have a focus on impact-oriented investment, to get their perspective as well as the knowledge of the deep knowledge and breadth across the investment committee with members that have significant experience in the financial industry. I already covered returns, so I'm now going to turn to slide 9 to provide some highlights for you. And what I wanted to do on this call was give the investors a good feel for how well the Joint Investment Committee is working together. And so you'll see in the first bullet point the topics that were discussed jointly with the Investment Committee and the Socially Responsible Investment Committee together. And the topics were updating our socially responsible investment policy. This is something that took some work with Tim's help, as well as representatives from both committees to take a look at what the investment policy says, what actions have taken place at GA, and make sure that we're incorporating them into policy. And this will now become a discipline that the Joint Committee updates on a regular basis. Why I think that's important is that we're focused on returns, but we're also focused on managing our fund in a way that reflects our values. And you really need to have the buy-in from both committees thinking about it from their perspectives and what their what the policy allows them to do, but it I think allowed us to feel more confident about the types of decisions that we're making, and recognizing that there are some real benefits that we're realizing in return, but also in how we're putting the money to work. We're still in the process of completing this update. It's going to circulate around both committees, and then we'll meet and provide feedback at the next meeting. But I think it's an excellent example of how well the two committees are working together. The screening criteria, we recently at one of our meetings had Sustainalytics come in and explain exactly how their criteria works in identifying and ranking companies in terms of ESG. And so a subcommittee, again, members of both the SRIC and the IC participated. And while we didn't make much progress, partly because ESG has become such a hot topic in the financial industry, Sustainalytics is working on a new ranking system that we think is going to be very helpful at allowing us to fine-tune even further what we want our universe to be and how exactly that criteria will be used. So look for further updates there. And then the performance review is something that we do jointly. The investment decisions reside, the decision-making capacity resides with the investment committee, but we are all charged with making sure that the performance is where we need it to be and all the pieces are working together. So I think I think this is a great way of showing all of you the importance of combining different perspectives and still being able to deliver a quality product. And then on to the more traditional side, the investment committee, as I mentioned a few moments ago, we spent a fair amount of time with the consultant talking about opportunistic investment. Their view is not quite aligned with where we are currently, so we're going to continue to discuss this, because GMO is certainly a manager that is not delivering up to our expectations, and we want to make sure that we're using that opportunistic allocation appropriately. The one other area where we have put it into the opportunistic category is Sevian Capital, which has a specialty expertise in the European markets and is a hedge fund strategy. And so while we're not targeting specific hedge funds, if we believe that it is going to be a differentiator in terms of correlations, that we think it's a solid investment process able to deliver return, that makes sense to us. So we will continue to tweak that portion of the portfolio as a source of return. And then the last highlight is that we did review 3 impact-oriented private market opportunities. All of the discussions at the investment committee only time frame in the agenda are open, as always, to the public, but we also welcome any of the members of the Socially Responsible Investment Committee to stay for that portion. And what we've discovered is that, for the most part, unless someone's schedule doesn't allow them to stay longer, we're really having broad participation with both committees. And I think that is a tremendous amount of progress in a relatively short period of time, and also indicates the commitment to our UUA values and our commitment to the fund that we all share and look forward to continuing to work for you. And I think that's probably a good segue for me to turn it over to Kathy Mulvey, who is the chair of the Socially Responsible Investment Committee.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kathleen. And I second your description of how well the integration of the committees and our work is going. And I think that applies all across the 3 key strategies of socially responsible investing. So the community investing that we do, the screening of our portfolio, and the shareholder advocacy. I think we had a great opportunity at General Assembly back in June to update and engage UUs and congregations with a couple of key workshops, and I was going to share a few highlights in particular from the one updating on our progress in implementing the 2014 business resolution on fossil fuel divestment. But we also had a great session on advancing racial equity through impact investing, which featured, along with Tim and Taquina Boston from the UUA, our newest member of the Socially Responsible Investing Committee, Pat Tamino of Zevin Asset Management. Looking at slide 11 here, this is an illustration of the range of investor partners that the UUA collaborates with on shareholder advocacy. So it's faith-based and other groupings, and these collaborations highlighted here are particularly around climate and around political spending and lobbying. We also have allies that we work with in the human rights space as well. So looking at slide 12, this time of year is really a good time to take stock of progress that's been made with our shareholder advocacy and engagement, as we also then begin to develop strategies for the year ahead. And so we are active in a range, as illustrated on the previous slide, of investor coalitions. We file and co-file resolutions. We participate in high-level meetings with company management. Tim's very active on that front. And then we're also signing on to statements and letters on issues that align with our values and with the socially responsible investing guidelines that Kathleen was speaking about. So, sort of updating those in the current context. And we also did a kind of deep dive into our proxy voting guidelines this spring to make sure that was aligned with our current with current conditions and with the latest developments in terms of the guidance that we get from the association as a whole. So looking at slide 13, this is one that actually Kim all of these are slides that Tim featured in his presentation at General Assembly on the progress in implementing the business resolution on fossil fuel divestment. And you can see that, you know, we play a key role in the socially responsible investing community in filing and co-filing resolutions. And several of these had really important support and substantial support this year. And I want to call out specifically the resolution on methane management with Range Resources that you was the lead filer on, that got more than half of the votes cast. So that has actually been an interesting lesson and learning for us in terms of how we engage in the process, in that that Tim can speak more to this, but we put significant effort into doing an SEC filing, calling for support from shareholders on that, and it really seems to have paid off. So we're, you know, considering how that informs the strategy going forward, as
and,
well
and
as really.
Kathy,
go ahead.
I actually kind of a little addendum to that. We had a call yesterday with Range Management as a follow-up to the resolution. And I was also joined by Stephen Heim of Boston Common Asset Management. He's done a lot of work in the methane world. And it was quite a call. They said we basically had four asks in that memo that you referenced, four things we wanted them to do, which they weren't doing. And they agreed to all of it yesterday.
Wow.
And they also said... Stephen invited them to come to a meeting that's happening at the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility in October that will be attended by some of the other companies in this field, and they agreed to come to that. So I just thought that was pretty amazing. I think that vote really got their attention, and now they're going to be doing exactly what we think they are. I mean, so important, as you know, because methane, if there's leakage, it's actually, from a climate perspective, worse than coal. So they are now, they say, committing to a target of zero fugitive emissions, which is,
wow.
That's the most I've heard from any of these companies. The good ones are doing less than 1%, but they're saying they're targeting zero.
Excellent. Thanks, Tim, for that update. That's fantastic. And so I think, you know, part of what we've been talking about is both the value of these memos and then also the value of, the memo I know took a fair bit of resources. And so, you know, thinking about how we can strategically apply our resources we definitely have an outsized impact in terms of shareholder advocacy and in terms of the whole socially responsible investing field and how best to apply that going forward as we think about filing future resolutions. And also, you know, in the climate space in particular, the role that we are playing in the new initiative, which I think Tim has spoken about on previous calls, the Climate Action 100+, which is an initiative involving, I think, close to 300 institutional investors now with more than $30 trillion in assets under management that are really setting out to engage with some of the companies that have the greatest climate impact. And Tim, I don't know if you want to say anything more about that or leave that for questions.
I'll just say that so we're working, so the way this works is that the investors divided up the companies. And we're a co-lead on Exelon, which is a big public utility. We're a collaborator on Xcel, which is another big utility. And then we are the lead investor on Devon, which is an oil and gas company. And so that process is just getting started.
Great. Yeah, so I think this is actually probably a good time to turn it back to you, Tim, to moderate any questions.
Great, and thank you. I have one other quick update, too. So on this slide, it mentions Exxon on lobbying and election spending. So we had the dialogue And one of the things we talked about was their membership in ALEC, A-L-E-C, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has taken some very backward positions on climate legislation. And just maybe 2 weeks ago or something, Exxon announced they were quitting ALEC, which I think is really a great signal to the marketplace. So with that, let's open it up for questions. What I will ask is that after you ask your question, would you please mute your phone? So all of you have the ability to unmute your phone right now if you press *6, then ask your question, and then hit *6 again to mute your phone, and that'll keep the whole call a lot quieter and allow people to hear. So do I have any brave person who wants to step to the front of the line and press *6 and ask a question of either any of us?
I'll ask a question. Now, this is Mike Kramer with Jefferson Unitarian Church in Golden, Colorado. Could you say a bit more, perhaps Kathleen could address this, on Sands, on their upside performance? What are they doing that others are not to achieve higher returns? And by the same token, GMA and the opportunistic investments, what's going wrong there more specifically than you have said so far? Thank you.
Those are great questions, Mike. Sands, as I mentioned, is our one of our growth equity managers. That is their focus, to identify companies and they're, that are going to continue to grow at a fast pace, and thus the expected return is higher than the broad equity market. They're benched to the Russell 1000 growth, which means we're measuring them relative to other growth managers. On a one-year basis, they've added close to 600 basis points, which you're correct is strong outperformance. They go through periods when growth is not necessarily favorable, where they're underperforming, and it's their ability, I think, to, one, know their companies really well, be disciplined on price, and stick with those companies for the long term. They've been in to visit us. They have a very long track record. If you look over to the far right, you'll see that the 10-year number is 15.7 versus the Russell 1000 growth at 12.4. And I would say that for a good growth manager should be able to add alpha relative to a growth index, and they're clearly able to do that.
So, Kathleen, can I add something?
Add anything more, sure.
Yeah, so the other thing to note, I think, is that Sands has a very concentrated portfolio. So they only have about 25 companies in the whole portfolio. And they, while we benchmark them against the Russell, they don't care about the benchmark. They're doing fundamental research and trying to find companies that they think have a potential for long-term growth. And so that means sometimes they're gonna buy a company on the way down because they think it has long-term potential, and then they might not perform so well. But I think it's that active management combined with the very concentrated portfolio that makes them not look like the benchmark at all. And hopefully it's mostly overperformance. But sometimes they're going to, you know, buy companies that the market is not favoring that they think have long-term potential. And I think, you know, over the long term, they've shown that they have the ability to do that.
Thanks for providing that additional detail, Tim. And that ties in with the importance of manager selection and active management, which I think we've been able to identify here. Now, on the downside, Mike, as you mentioned, GMO, which GMO stands for Grantham Mayo Otterloo, is an investment manager actually local here in Boston. You may or may not recognize Grantham as Jeremy Grantham, well-respected manager. They have a strategy that I believe falls into what is called global tactical asset allocation. It's a type of strategy that is it's meant to be uncorrelated, to really be able to be that diversifier in a large portfolio. They tend to do well when the markets do really, really poorly. And so we really haven't had a market in a long time that has given them an opportunity to perform that role. It's also something that, with our understanding, they've got a broad benchmark which allows them to invest in almost an unconstrained way, and yet it's in a structure where they do need to, because it's a fund structure, they do need to think about daily liquidity. They've been in and met with the investment committee earlier this year. They've been on our watch list. We are concerned about valuations in the market and have been thinking that with a big hiccup in the market, that that role that they've been playing in the portfolio might be a good time to exit. But our patience is wearing out. And we will update you on what our decision is. We didn't reach a conclusion at the most recent meeting, but as we further define what opportunistic means, we're not gaining that diversification role that we would seek to get from this category of investments. It's the one manager that really, I would say, stands out as not fitting in over the long term. We're very aware of that. But I think when you stack that up to the very strong stable of managers we have built in with our consultants in the equity, fixed, and the private market areas, and the hedge fund area with Sevian, that's how we're able to achieve the returns that we've been able to with the entire portfolio. It's not unusual to have an outlier, and you're right to focus on it, and it's certainly on our radar and a priority for us to deal with as well. I hope that gives you some good transparency on our views.
Thank you,
okay,
Kathleen.
So, yeah.
Another question?
Well, can we let others have a chance, and then if nobody has questions, we can come back?
Well, I'm one of those who wants a chance to ask a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought it was the same person. Go ahead. Yes. My question, again, is for the investment.
Who is that?
My name is Bob Downey from the Unitarian Church in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I was wondering if you could please say something more about the allocation index and the policy index. How do you arrive at these? Where do they come from?
Can I take that one, Kathleen?
Definitely.
So if you go to slide 5, 6, and 7. So let's look at slide 5. And what you will see on slide 5 is for each manager, there is a, it says the manager, so let's go, you know, under domestic equity. If you look at Rumline, then it says Russell 1000 value. So that is the benchmark for that manager. And if you go down the whole list of managers, every manager is tied to an index that is specifically tied to their kind of a strategy. Then if you go over a couple of columns, you'll see it says percent of portfolio. So what the allocation index is it's a weighted average of all of those benchmarks by the actual percent of the portfolio. So, you know, the so that, you know, like Rumline is 10.7% of the portfolio. So the Russell 1000 value is 10.7% of the allocation index and on down the line. If you go over to the next column, that's the policy percentage. So those are the targets that the committee has set. So the policy index, again, is a weighted average of all those underlying benchmarks allocated according to the percentage target. Did that help?
And, Tim, if I can just add, to Tim's credit, our process is one where Tim is looking at the allocation and the policy, and while you do see that Sands is at 11.4 versus 10.5, we've been tapping into that appreciation all along, and when we're outside of the range, we simply discipline back, discipline ourselves to move back to policy target, which helps us take advantage of those outsized gains, but we're not letting them ride. And I think all good investment practitioners and institutional investors that I've come across over the years use that type of disciplined approach to rebalance on a continual basis. And I think that goes a long way to explaining rankings versus our peers.
Great. So do we have another question? Is everybody just trying to get back to the beach? So I have a question, Kathleen. So the overall market environment certainly seems to be changing. You know, we're seeing more volatility. You know, your world of fixed income, we're seeing the compression of yield. What does that tell you about the role of active management?
That's a great question. I think this is exactly the type of environment where you do want to have managers who have a strategy, a discipline that doesn't tie them to a broad benchmark because of where valuations are, with the change in the market environment where it's less about what central banks are doing and more about politicians, it's not markets all moving in one direction, which has been up. You're going to see certain parts of the markets get hit at different times. So having the right policy and having the right blend of market exposure with active management makes makes it possible to navigate much choppier markets, and I think it will allow us to maximize returns through what is likely to be an environment where returns from areas that we've come to rely on, particularly the developed markets in the U.S. And away from the U.S., developed markets like Europe and Japan, as interest rates globally rise. And part of the policy tilt that we've put into position is to have some non-U.S. exposure that I think we will benefit from. NEPC recently sent out an update to all of us, and we did talk briefly at the committee about the value that's being created in emerging markets right now, with some of the market concerns. And while we don't have broad exposure there, selectively we do, and I think that's a good way of recognizing value in the markets without taking a tremendous amount of risk. So opportunities are certainly coming our way, and we will be prepared to take advantage of them.
Great, thank you. Does anyone else have a question? Or Kathy, Kathleen, or me? Okay, so I'm not hearing any questions. If the call ends and one suddenly occurs to you, feel free to shoot an email or give a call. Contact information is on the slide deck. You won't get a response until next week because I am away for the weekend. But we're always happy to talk to our investors and answer questions, so feel free to ask questions. So I just want to thank very much all of you for joining us. I think it's your engagement that keeps us honest and really keeps us on our toes. And I want to thank Kathleen very much for your service as the committee chair, investment committee chair, and for being on this call today. And thanks to Kathy Mulvey for your role in leading the Socially Responsible Investing Committee and for being on the call today. And also thanks to Susan Helbert, Assistant to the Treasurer, who organizes these calls and puts together the materials. I really appreciate that. So thanks to all of you, and we will be talking to you in a quarter, and we'll see what happens over the next 3 months. I think it's going to be interesting. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.